My name is Andrew Zai, and I'm the Social Media Chairman for the IEEE International Symposium on Phased Array Systems and Technology being held in Boston in 2019. As I've said in the previous podcast, I'm trying to do things a little differently, and instead of just posting text to the social media pages, I'm creating interesting audio content for our attendees to listen to. This week, I interview Conference Chairman Jeff Hurd from MIT Lincoln Laboratory. In the episode, we talk about the conference and some logistics, but also we talk about some interesting work he's doing at Lincoln Laboratory to develop low-cost phased arrays. A few announcements before we start. Our website is now up and running at array2019.org. Please visit the site to get details about the conference. Also, you can now submit papers, so please visit the website. If you have any comments or have an interesting guest that I can interview for the podcast, please feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn or directly at my website, andrewzai.com. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy the episode. All right, so I'm here today with Jeff Hurd. He is a group leader at MIT Lincoln Laboratory. He runs the Advanced RF Techniques Group. So why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself? I'm somewhat interested in your past and how you got to where you are today. So why don't you start at the beginning? Where did you go to school?
Well, my alma mater is the University of Massachusetts out at Amherst. And I studied there for actually three degrees. I studied for the bachelor's, the master's, and the PhD, all in electrical engineering. And my advisor there in graduate school was Dave Pozar, who's written a couple of books in microwave engineering, and that's his specialty area, mm-hmm. and in particular microwave engineering and antenna arrays. And my work with him was in the research and analysis of phased array antennas, in particular microstrip antenna arrays.
So you're being a little modest there. Your advisor, David Pozar, he literally wrote the book on microwave engineering. It's actually what my background is as well. So it's very interesting that you were doing phased arrays even all the way back then. Can you talk a little bit more about what your PhD thesis was?
Sure. The time that was in the early 80s when I was doing my master's thesis, and there was an advent of technology that was just getting popular then. That was these microstrip arrays, which, as you know, are printed circuit antennas that are built on very thin substrates. So they have the potential to be very lightweight, very low cost, and they at that time they were very appealing to be for conformal applications, and they still are. The difficulty was that people really didn't have a good way to model them and to design them and get the frequency performance and the bandwidths and so forth correct. So the work that Dave Pozar was doing was pioneering the analysis of those types of geometries and structures. And my role in that was to explore the use of multiple layer patches for getting broader bandwidth in arrays.
And so I guess what were the modeling tools like back then? I know now I just designed an antenna myself, and you know, I use a couple of tools. I used FICO, I also use HFSS, so you can get really high fidelity modeling on that. But was the modeling aspect part of what you were doing?
Or? It was, and at that time, there was still, prior to the advent of all the commercial codes that you can now get essentially off the shelf, it was also about the time when techniques like the method of moments were coming into play for numerical analysis using full digital techniques rather than analytical techniques. So we were using computational electromagnetics to calculate all the fields and currents of these structures. So Dave Pozar's major contribution was in applying these method of moments type of approaches to the microstrip antenna array problem. At that time, as I say, we didn't have off-the-shelf code, so everything we did was custom. We mm-hmm. wrote these integral equations and the solvers for them in Fortran code, and then essentially had to compile and run those on the mainframe computers.
Wow.
You're the real deal. I just, I buy the software package and run the optimizer till my antenna works, but you actually had to write the code. That's very interesting.
Well, I think that one of the benefits of that was, looking back, and something that I know that Dave has commented, is that you gain a certain amount of insight when you have to do checks on physical reality of what you're getting for results, because you're constantly making sure that there's no mistakes and or any particular problems. I think you get lulled a little bit into a sense of security when you're just using code, because you assume that everything is going to go just right, and maybe take a little less concern about making sure that the physical properties are actually behaving the way they should. So that's my biggest concern.
I can't remember the amount of times where I've run a simulation only for it not to work because I didn't set the port right or the boundaries were off or something like that. So you really get into it. Anyway, so did you go straight through to get your PhD or?
Actually, after I got my master's, I went to work for the Air Force Research Lab, and that's a laboratory that does basic research. And in the particular, I worked in the antenna group in the Electromagnetics Directorate, and this is at Hanscom Air Force Base in Massachusetts. And so the job of that group was to explore research and development in electromagnetics, mainly for antennas. And in particular, their focus was on phased arrays, so it was a great match to the work that I had been doing in my master's level research.
And so when did you make the transition over to Lincoln Lab? I know Hanscom Air Force Base, I think I can, well, technically Lincoln Lab's on it, but yeah, I can see the gate from where I'm sitting, so you didn't have to move very far physically once you transitioned jobs, but how did you make your way over to Lincoln?
Well, the first the in between the master's and leaving AFRL, I had an opportunity to go to get another degree under a program there. It was a long-term training program, so I was supported for my PhD back at the University of Massachusetts. And then I returned to AFRL after finishing it and spent several more years there working in the group. There was in the late 90s, there was a move to change location of that group out to Dayton, Ohio. And at that point, I made the decision that I would move to Lincoln Laboratory because it was going to stay where it is, and I really wanted to remain in Massachusetts. So that was the reason I made that move.
And so I know there's very few leadership positions available at Lincoln Lab. So and you seem to have had a very successful career thus far. So do you have any kind of insights for the younger listeners on how they can, separate themselves from their peers wherever they may be working?
Well, sure. I think, at Lincoln Laboratory, I was fortunate to get on board at a time when they were looking for new group, a new area of development in taking advantage of phased arrays and applying them to radar and communications and electronic support. And so it was in the right place at the right time to form up and hire and get funding in the area of RF systems and RF phased arrays. So that's really what I'd sort of gelled around me was a group that does all the things you need to do to build RF systems. That's the antennas and feed networks and modules, the chips receivers and exciters and so forth. So that group has really been built up over 15 years of time, and that's not just people, it's also the infrastructure like measurement equipment and test equipment and space. So yeah, it's been a long process, and I guess I would advise more than anything else that people set goals and stick to them and be patient, and you'll find your way to achieving them.
Awesome. All right, so let's move on to more of the reason why we're here today. You are the chairman of the what's the official title? I always shorthand it and call it the Phased Array Conference,
Well,
but
I guess the official term is the Phased Array Systems and Technology Conference.
great. And so what is the purpose of this conference?
Well, so the focus of the conference is truly on the phased arrays, and it kind of breaks out into the technologies that are relevant to phased arrays and new capabilities. And it's also a venue where we can talk about the different applications of phased arrays. And as the technologies mature and become more affordable, the applications get broader. And mm-hmm. now I think we're starting to see significantly entry points of phased arrays beyond the traditional military mm-hmm. application space and now into commercial space, which I think is very exciting.
Yeah, you sort of robbed me of my next question there. I was going to kind of suppose that historically it's been very DoD, Department of Defense focused, but now with 5G coming online, I'm wondering if you are hoping that you get more of a representation of the commercial sector now.
I absolutely do, and we saw a little bit of that in 2016 for the last conference, and we were starting to just be on the early cusp of that. And so I've no doubt that in the next conference that we have in the 2019 in October, that the 5G presence will be very strong. There's a rapidly developing technology base there. Of course, there's large investments being made, and I think that that's a very exciting new area for us. It also, the pace of development is significantly faster than what we normally see in a DoD-based type of technology. And so I think that will make us revisit the timing of the conference, which has typically been 3 years intervals. I think we're probably going to be looking at doing that more regularly as a result of that.
All right, folks, you heard it here first. We're changing the schedule. All right, so what's the format? Is this a typical, follows a typical academic style? There's a plenary session and some exhibits and such?
Well, that's exactly right. There's typically what we do is we'll have parallel sessions, four parallel sessions that are oral, and the format is, as you say, is fairly typical. It's presentation style in auditorium. We also do have poster sessions. It turns out that there are people that prefer posters because of the interactive engagement, and so we have several poster sessions. There will be tutorials that we arrange on the day before and the day after the oral sessions, and that's a great opportunity for people, particularly those that are getting into the area. They want to learn from world experts about aspects of phased array technologies, and of course the last bit is, as you mentioned, is we're going to have, as we have in the past, an exhibitor space for companies to show their new technologies and capabilities, and anybody else, for example, academics sometimes have booths or in societies and so forth.
And so for the technical portions, the talks and the posters, is it, I know I'm sure it's a mix of both, but is it primarily more industry presenting, or is it academia, professors and students?
Well, it's interesting. It's actually what I see happen primarily is that the industry presentations seem to be a strong component of it, because I think the development cycle of big phased array systems tends to be multiple years and many, many dollars invested. And so I think the enterprise of that rests largely in industry. Mm-hmm. And so the exception there is that the academic presence is there to show the modeling and simulation and theory. But they also, but what I find is that group will often present on a more shorter intervals of time on a yearly basis, mm-hmm. and so the 3 year conference intervals is a little less matched to that pace. So the answer is that we do have a mixture of academic, industry, and laboratories, but I think the dominant one is industry.
Yeah. Okay. There's a need for both those types of conferences, but it's interesting to hear that industry is very involved in this one. So are you excited for anything in particular this year? Do you have any keynote speakers you're considering, or any new features that you're rolling out?
Well, I don't want to let the cat out of the bag just yet, but we are working already on our plenary talks, and typically what we'll do is we'll invite speakers from an international community to try to represent activities that are going on in Europe and in Asia, and we'll also be getting strong representation from the industry performers that are, you know, as I said before, they typically are working on rather, you know, large and long-term development efforts, and they'll give us a snapshot of where things are there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, yes, we are working on that agenda right now and putting together our tutorials, and we'll be coming out fairly soon with a list of all that.
Awesome. And so for the commercial telecom guys who are doing more of the 5G stuff, is there any companies that you hope to will submit some technical information? And
well, absolutely. I think the I guess I won't highlight any particular one, but I think that's a very rich area of development. It's also one with a lot of competition in it. So I think that what we're going to see is the question I wonder about is whether or not people are going to be showing detailed designs. I think that most likely we'll be seeing some work that's been done in academia that supports 5G and that's more publishable. So I guess it's such a competitive area. I guess we'll have to see how much people are willing to talk about their actual proprietary or potentially proprietary type of information.
Okay, so for anyone listening, I don't know how many people who don't know what a phased array will tune into this, but let's just play devil's advocate. Why don't you go ahead and tell us what a phased array is and how it's different from mechanically scanned antennas?
Sure. So everybody, I think, knows what a dish antenna is because you see them at the airport, and basically it's a big mechanical structure that you steer by physically moving the antenna, and that requires a mechanical gimbal, and it's usually the least expensive way to aim an antenna. The problem is that it has failure modes in the mechanical systems like gimbals, and the other problem is that it has a single point of failure because the power supply for that system is typically one, and if that breaks or goes down, then you're off the air. Mm-hmm. A phased array, on the other hand, actually uses a different approach to steer the beam. It breaks the antenna up into many small elements that are closely spaced with one another on the order of a wavelength or half a wavelength, and then it controls the relative phase between those antennas so that you can essentially tilt the wavefront of energy that's leaving the array or coming to the array, mm-hmm. and it focuses it off in different directions. Now that focusing or steering can be done very quickly because it is done with electronic components that can switch on the order of microseconds. So the main advantage I see of a phased array is this very rapid electronic steering and repointing. And the second big advantage of that, I say, is the robustness to graceful its failure. It has a graceful failure or graceful degradation because it's unlikely that all of the active electronics are going to fail at once. In fact, typically they fail gradually, and the performance of the array consistently with that just degrades gracefully. And I think that's a very good feature mm-hmm. for a system to have. So, and I guess the last thing I would add is because you're putting all the amplifiers in the aperture of the array, you're actually able to get much higher efficiencies, and there are lower losses that you would normally encounter by running energy from point A to point B. Everything's very close, and the amplifier and the energy that's leaving the array is very short path, so that it tends to be much higher efficiency as a result.
Yeah, with microwave at microwave frequencies, even an inch of line starting to impact the loss of your system, and in radar in particular, you're counting every tenth of a dB. So the closer you can get that amplifier to the antenna, the better off you are. I fully agree with your comments on the fast electronic steering. I think that folds in nicely with the guest I spoke with last time, the fighter pilot Ray O'Mara, mm-hmm. and he was saying in his flying days he actually had one of those mechanical dishes in his the nose cone of his jet. So if he's fighting with or tracking multiple planes, he could he had to wait for the antenna to scan between the two of those. But with your microsecond level switching, you can quickly switch between multiple targets. So it's a very powerful performance increase in a radar system. But so what are some of the disadvantages of a phased array system?
Well, I think probably the first and foremost, the complexity of the system, because now you have sort of thousands of these, typically thousands of elements in it, and each one has to have its own power and control and packaging and thermal management. So it becomes a much more complicated system as to get this extra capability. And so I really think that it's the complexity and cost that are the major disadvantages of the change from a very simple dish with a single feed to a multi-element phased array. That's really the penalty that you have to pay to get that extra capability.
And yeah, so as I have a presentation that you were kind enough to share with me before, but the program you're working on now is really trying to attack the cost of phased arrays, because that's a tough number to swallow, especially for the commercial sector. And some of the DoD systems that you highlight, there's one that spends $196 million a year just to build 14 units every year. And then for the other two, it climbs up to $260 million for six units, and lastly, $360 million for a set of radars every year to get these out to the warfighter. So obviously that would not be supportable by the commercial sector. I mean, how many cell towers are there in a 10-mile radius? You're probably at your 14 units right there, and Verizon's not going to pay $196 million to cover a couple of square miles. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the program that you're working on here at Lincoln Labs and how it's trying to address these cost issues?
Sure. Well, there are some significant differences in cost structures for military systems and those for commercial. But the most significant one is that the non-recurring costs, the non-recurring engineering of systems that are done for the DoD typically dominates in the beginning, obviously. It doesn't get recaptured as easily over the volumes, because the volumes of the systems tend to be much lower. As you mentioned, these typical systems that you described, there are tens of units per year that are built, not thousands or millions. So it's a very different return on investment when you put in a non-recurring engineering into the development. That's one strong reason why the cost is high. The second one, I think, is just about the way that the systems are built. It's a combination of things, and we've been looking closely at all the factors that contribute, but it tends to be things like use of the expensive packaging, meaning the metal housings that we put things inside of are expensive. The bulk material costs for boards, circuit boards, the connectors and cables are expensive. You can imagine how every connector can be, if it's a high quality, low loss connector, can go up to $50 to $100. And you'll have many of those in an array, thousands of those. And so all these costs add up. I think that last but not least, I think there's a lot of touch labor in these types of arrays that are built in what I call a slab assembly. So they're not easy to automate the assembly and test. So these are all the factors, I think, that really dominate the cost of building traditional sort of DoD phased arrays. And with the program that you mentioned, it's that we've been working on, it's trying to tackle these costs and introduce a different approach to building them that is more consistent with a high volume commercial manufacturing approach. And this program is called Multifunction Phased Array Radar. It's recently been renamed or broadened to be called the sensor program. And it's the idea that we've been working on is to try to reduce materials, connectors, packaging, and assembly and test costs by going to, again, the techniques that are used in high volume microwave commercial techniques, like in our cell phones. So there are trade-offs that you have to make. For example, when you do that, you typically give up the hermeticity of the packaging and the enclosures. Mm-hmm. So you have to manage the environment of that system in a different way. So that's one, I think, sort of thing that we have to give up. I think the other thing that we have to look at is the level of what we call a line replaceable unit has changed. It used to be that that line replaceable unit was a module at every element, and you would plug that in and replace it if it was broken. Now what we're talking about is the next level up of assembly, where the line replaceable unit is actually more like of a tile, something like maybe 14 element, or 16 elements, or 64 elements, or even 256 elements. So it's a building block that you use that scales, and so that's a very different way of thinking than the traditional sort of element level module approach.
So yeah, back to your presentation here, sort of the typical SLAT architecture approach that's used today, what it looks like is you have, if you have your array face perpendicular to that, you have a series of boards, and each of those boards has several rows. So you would have a 2D array, the boards by rows, and then at the end of those rows is for a single row is a antenna element with some microwave matching circuit maybe. And then you have your TR module, and this is a typical microwave module where you have maybe some MMICs epoxy down on the board and you wire bond to that. And this is probably very technician intensive, which is probably also a huge cost driver. But so it looks like what you've done here is now you just have fully not microwave module boards. You have chips, just it looks like they're probably soldered down onto that. Can you talk a little bit about how your tiles are manufactured?
Yes, I can. That's a great observation. I think those packages are solder mounted. We have sought to use these so-called quad flat no lead packages, which mm-hmm. are an industry standard, which helps because that it's quite easy to get the equipment for automated pick and place. And the design of those packages is standardized, so it lends itself very well to the high volume approach. And the key to reducing the cost of the interconnects is to put as much as possible into the multi-layer boards themselves. And nowadays there's quite a bit of industry that available in competitive pricing on these multi-layer laminate boards that have combinations of layers that are for microwave transmission lines and combining networks, and other layers that are for control and DC power distribution. So we try to keep an approach that has the fewest number of connectors and cables as possible. And for example, the MPAR tile that we're currently deploying has something like 8 RF connectors on it. And it has very few, essentially 8 cables that come off of that. Mm-hmm. And that's really a major benefit to it. And the other thing is because we use a tile, it's flat, and it lends itself very well to an automated pick and place and for automated test as well.
Wow. So the actual antenna array there looks very familiar. It sounds straight out of what you were probably designing in grad school. How much say did you have over choosing that as the antenna?
Well, yeah, I did. I had quite a bit. It turns out that, as I mentioned earlier, the microstrip type of arrays are very well suited to flat, thin type of geometries, and they're also very low cost because they're printed on circuit board material. So I was an advocate from the very beginning. As it turns out that the MPAR system has a need for two polarizations, dual polarization. And there are some very very nice designs that you can do in digital stack patch arrays that give you both bandwidth, enough bandwidth for the job, and a very nice balanced low cross pole in the array far field. So those are things that we were looking for, and so it made a natural choice for the for this particular type of application.
Wow. And it looks like from your projections here, it looks like you predict you'll be able to drive the cost down to $60,000 for a meter squared by the time it's all said and done in full production.
That's right. Yeah, there's several things that influence that cost, and we're heading very well towards that target. And we're about a factor of two to go. but we've only at this point built several hundred of those tiles, and I think that as we build more, we will, the way the cost comes down is through the volume of material purchasing, so you get better pricing. I think the other thing is investments that are made in the line, in the testing and assembly equipment. The investments are made that are recapitalized by those sales. So yeah. the higher volume just equates directly to lower price, and we're seeing that in action here.
Yeah. Well, you may be a factor of two off of your final goal, but I think you're a factor of 20 down from where you started. So that's
correct.
And also, that's already low cost compared to these slat. You don't have that number. You're very forgiving to your competitors there. But
well, I like to be fair. In this particular application is a relatively modest power level, so most of the comparisons that you think of have to do with very high power, military systems. So we're at a fairly low power density. So I think the actual detail comparison would show that we're a solid factor of five times less expensive than the alternative approach. And then if you go to higher power levels, I would say we'll quickly get to be closer to 10x less expensive.
So are you at liberty to talk about some of the more technical features, like the band of operation and like the transmit power out of a single element?
Yes, I'm glad to. This is an S-band dual pole array. And the reason it's dual polarized is that the application calls for multiple functions, weather and aircraft surveillance. The weather surveillance piece requires two polarizations that the meteorologist uses to measure and predict rain rate, as it turns out. So we need to have very accurate comparison between vertical and horizontal polarization. And that's a unique feature in an array. And it typically drives cost, and it also it complicates the array design, because you have to try to maintain low cross-pole isolation or high cross-pole isolation, low cross-pole component over the whole scan volume. And so that's a challenge. If you compare the operation of this system, which is an electronically steered array, with the traditional mechanically steered systems, they can get very low cross-pole because they're just always pointing the antenna at broadside. And we're steering as much as 60 degrees off of broadside. And as we do that, it gets harder and more challenging to have cross-pole isolation. So that's one of the biggest challenges that we're trying to experimentally verify, is how well we can control that. Another aspect of this array which is unique is it has a digital subarrays in it. And we can actually use the architecture to form multiple beam clusters. It can form 6x2 beam clusters, which is convenient for very fast surveillance mm-hmm. of the scan volume. And so that's something that utilizes a technique called overlap subarrays, and that's built into the tile architecture, in the multi-layer boards in the strip line networks there. And I think that's a unique way to do it, and it's also a very inexpensive way to implement that.
So that's, that's digital beamforming, correct?
That's digital beamforming, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so the idea being that you transmit one pulse, but then you record all your channels simultaneously, and then you can just look at different areas within your beam pattern via digital processing.
That's correct. You form a wide transmit beam, we call it a spoiled beam, and then you intercept that beam with multiple receive beams that are all high gain, and then you process them simultaneously.
Yeah. So... this isn't merely just some academic exercise where you made a single tile in your lab and measured it in an anechoic change bearer or something like that. It's actually a fairly mature system. So do you care to talk about some of the things you've done to date?
Sure. Yeah, the first thing, we of course did start with single tiles or several tiles together, just to figure out how to operate them and how to calibrate them, and how to cool them and so forth. But after we sorted those things out, we jumped up to a 10 panel, which is a 640 element array, which is a size that's big enough to be able to take a look at the outdoor performance as a radar. And so that demonstrator has been in use now since 2015 out in Oklahoma, and they've been verifying their calibration techniques and just assessing the performance of the system for weather and aircraft surveillance. And then, so the success of that demonstrator actually led to a decision to move forward to build a 76 tile array, which is just a little less than 5,000 elements. And we've completed that build, and we're just finishing up the testing of that in our near field chamber here at Lincoln Laboratory. The plan is that in the next several weeks, it will be disassembled and shipped out to Norman, Oklahoma, to the sponsor there, which is the National Severe Storms Laboratory, and it'll be reinstalled and calibrated, and then go through acceptance testing. So it's a fairly big step to build an array of that size, and it will provide a very unique resource for experimenting with dual pole and multiple functions in a phased array.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm kind of going through this right now with where I'm working. And so we took this, you know, prototype that was very well massaged, and one of the two PhDs in microwave engineering there would always have to babysit this thing and adjust the attenuator values here and there to make sure that it was working properly. But it's a totally different animal going from that level of prototype to a system representable of what you can do in volume. Do you have any lessons learned from that? Was this sort of the first time you've had to make a transition like that, or is your group experienced in making that transition?
Well, I think there's always room to learn. We've gone through at least three generations of these system tiles, and each generation we learn something from the previous and try to make adjustments and changes, whether it's for performance reasons or for cost. For example, you know, adding additional control so that we can shut off elements when we're doing calibration, so we can minimize leakage and sort of co-channel interference, whether it's just techniques that we've learned in order to reduce the any particular failure modes that might reduce reliability, things like or any kind of degradation in performance due to for example, any kind of resonances, those sorts of things. So each of those steps along the way, we learned from our mistakes, and then we corrected them, and then moved forward. And I think you have to go through those steps. It's very difficult to predict those things ahead of time. You have to kind of go through it and learn them. And the bigger the array, the harder things get, I must say. Harder in the sense that there's scales of things that you're dealing with are thousands instead of hundreds or tens. And so, for example, when we test the near-field patterns of the array, we have something like 2,000 beam positions that we go through. Mm-hmm. So it's a very narrow beam, and there's many beam positions. So we want to be thorough. We want to check everything very carefully. So everything scales to a bigger problem when you have a bigger. But I should also add that there is a benefit of a large array in that you start to see the effects of the random errors in your favor, because the cancellation effects, just like everybody in the arrays knows, the larger the array, the lower the sort of random RMS side lobes get, because you get this cancellation effect. And the law of large numbers works in your favor.
Yeah, you're averaging out the errors.
Out the errors, and that's a very distinct feature when you get to arrays that are in the thousands of elements. You really see that, and it helps to get better behavior in the you know, in the side lobe structures and in the gain of the array and so forth. So I think that's something that we're learning. I think calibration is something it's an art that I would not underestimate, and we're still learning quite a bit about that, especially for dual polarization. And I think that's a challenging area and will continue to be challenging.
So what do you see being next for MPAR, or just maybe even just low cost arrays in general?
Well, I think you hit the right on the head. I think the key is to keep the thread of low cost, and then move into new applications that will stress the system in other ways. For example, if you want to apply this approach to higher powers for DoD, you have to figure out how to cool those higher power densities and the dissipated energy that goes with it. So we're looking at and working on architectures for tiles that include embedded liquid cooling, because at some point it's about 3,000 or 4,000 watts per square meter of radiated power. You can no longer use liquid cooling before you simply can't use the air to get the heat out. So you transition at that point into the need for liquid cooling, and at that point, so we're trying to figure out how to do this without changing the cost paradigm of, mm-hmm. of a tile, and I think we have some unique ideas there. I think the second challenge area that we're working in is moving to higher frequencies. The MPAR array that I just described is it's an S-band array, so it operates in the FAA band 2.7 up to 3.1 gigahertz, and the spacing of the elements is generous compared to the higher frequencies that many DoD systems operate at, X-band, Ku-band, or higher. And so I think the second challenge area for us is to figure out how to take the techniques that we've learned at S-band, these very tileable type architectures, and scale them up in frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And so the main challenge becomes now fit. You've got a unit cell for each element, which goes down as a function of frequency. And so you can imagine at, say, Ku band or 17 gigahertz, the lattice spacing is 1 centimeter. So mm-hmm. now you have to fit in a tile architecture. The entire electronics behind the element has to fit in 1 centimeter lattice. And so the packaging and cooling and interconnects all get harder and harder as you go higher in frequency.
Yeah, not to mention the RF losses just get, you know, they start ballooning up on you as you go higher up in frequency as well. You have to, I mean, God forbid you have to go to a frequency where you need to start using waveguides. That's exactly what you want to avoid.
That's right. Yeah, I think so. The certain things that are inherent to multi-layer printed circuit boards that have to do with the vias that transition from layer to layer, they have certain diameters, and at some point you just run up against hard stops in the way that those are built. So we're working on some ideas there about how to get higher frequencies and higher power densities, but it will require some very clever solutions to get the heat out and to route those signals around. But I think the other area I'd like to mention is that as you tackle these problems in cost that have to do with things like the cabling and the connectors and the board material, what you find is that the next most significant cost that adds up is in the chips themselves, the active components, the electronics, the semiconductor electronics that you use. And that is an area that we think that you need to really address if you want to get cost down significantly for these high power arrays. So that essentially it's the cost per watt of the semiconductors that are being used in the chipsets of the arrays, the active transmit receive components. And so I think the next big challenge area is to figure out how to get the cost of those chipsets down where you're down to dollars per watt or pennies per watt,
mm-hmm.
To be able to make them affordable.
So is it a gas system right now?
The system is a gallium arsenide based at this moment, and the next generation will be transitioning to gallium nitride because mm-hmm. of the its higher efficiency. And it's smaller chipsets and can operate at higher voltages, which gives you some benefits. So there are a number of things that make gallium nitride appealing. The challenge with gallium nitride is still in getting the cost per watt down.
Mm-hmm. If my advisor listens to this episode, she's probably very upset with this next question, but have you, because she's very involved in gallium nitride herself, but as you go up and up in frequency, have you considered switching into silicon instead? Because the output power is going to be smaller, but now if you make a same size array, I mean the antenna gain and the effective aperture of the array you're going to be leveraging the gain of your antennas at that point in the array size. Has that a game that you've considered playing?
It is. It's very true that sometimes if you go high enough in frequency and you have enough area, the number of elements gets so high per unit area that you really only need a few hundred milliwatts per element to achieve the
right
kinds of effective isotropic radiated power that you need. So there are two pitfalls or two challenges there. I think one is that with silicon, you can get several hundred milliwatts of output power, but that's about as much as you're going to mm-hmm. get. So you're going to hit an upper stop around that point, and so that might limit the application space. I think the second challenge there is going to be in the just figure out how to integrate both digital and analog together. I think if we'd like to have mixed signal solutions like in silicon germanium that can do both the digital control circuitry or any kind of low power, low voltage electronics. And in addition, we want to have essentially high efficiency, low loss RF components. So there's this sort of inherent challenge between those two. There's an area that's being looked at carefully over the last few years, which is to integrate GaN on silicon as opposed to GaN on silicon carbide. So by doing that, you potentially can do mixed signal gallium nitride for high power and high efficiency components like amplifiers and LNAs and switches, and then integrate other components, the low power, in silicon. So silicon CMOS for the things like phase shifters or signal processing control and so forth. So I think that's kind of like the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's some very promising efforts going on in that area.
Great. So is there any final thoughts you wanted to share with the audience?
Well, I think all the things we've been talking about, we've mainly been saying about the phased arrays that are either analog or digital subarray type of architectures. And I think what we're seeing coming very rapidly as a result primarily of the 5G developments is the architectures that go towards element level digital.
Mm-hmm.
And that in that case, you put the transceiver at the element itself. So you have to have analog to digital and digital analog conversions there at the element. But that's a very powerful architecture because it gives you lots of degrees of control. It simplifies the beamformers because it's done digitally rather than in an analog manifold. It makes the calibration and compensation of errors much simpler. So you have a lot of benefits. And I just think that I would say to the audience that you know, digital beamforming has been sort of always on the horizon for a long time. And I think we're finally at a point now where it's going to become much more ready to use.
Do you think, us analog microwave guys might have figured it all out, but do you think the digital back-end processing is at a point where it's ready to address processing
all
that data?
That's a great point. I think the interfacing, the I.O. of the data that we're talking about, if you have a gigahertz, let's say a bandwidth, and you have 5,000 elements, it's just an astronomical data management problem. So I think where the art and challenge is mainly going to be is in how to handle the data networking. And I think that's probably where a lot of the energy is going to be focused over the next 5 years is in digital networking of large arrays.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a good spot to be in. Our tough problems are getting solved every day by guys like you, but we'll kick the can down the road to those digital guys to process all that data we send them. All right, Jeff. Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to me today, and it was a real pleasure.
Andrew, thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.